Greetings, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to Beyond the Matrix, the radio program that unquestionably challenges you to think outside the box of convention and to explore with me and my great guests the many other possibilities available in the free thought zone. That's where we will journey to today during the program. Everything is available to us. No holding back. We are not mainstream. We are the alternative truth. And thank you for being part of that truth. So stay tuned. Here we go. Get ready for another hour of out there information. Great. Greetings, everybody. This is Patricia Corey, your host for Beyond the Matrix. And I said, get ready for out there hour. And of course, who better than Stanton T. Friedman to take us out further than usual? So I have with me today someone who I really, really respect, as you all know. He's been on my guest. He's been my guest a few times. And he's also in the book Beyond the Matrix. I think he's just back from Roswell, so we'll get the scoop on that. I'm talking about nuclear physicist, lecturer, UFO expert, the wonderful Stanton Friedman. He has degrees in physics from the University of Chicago. He was employed for 14 years as a nuclear physicist by several companies. And, you know, he's the man in UFOs. So without any further ado, hi, Stan.
Hi. Glad to be on again.
Thank you for coming back on. I know you've been really out there on the talking circuit, and there's just, you know, with these sightings, hundreds of sightings around the planet almost daily now, I know that you've got your finger on the pulse. So where would you like to begin with updating us on all you know?
Well, that would take too long. Yeah, I was in Roswell for 4 days. Back a couple weeks, they have their annual festival, and I'm usually there. And at the highest attendance in 3 years, I gave 2 lectures and was on 2 panels and did a number of interviews. You know, people have to understand, Roswell isn't on the way to anywhere. If you're there, it's because you want to be there. It's 200 miles from Albuquerque, 200 miles from Amarillo, 200 miles from El Paso. I mean, there's not a lot of people in between all those places, but still, the museum gets well over 100,000 visitors a year, which is pretty neat. And it was a pleasure. I do warn people it gets hot there. But
it
right
seemed
now,
like
I guess most of the country is hot.
I saw that they were having a parade and things like that, and I was just wondering if they were going to the festive side, like Star Trek reunions, more than the updated data.
No. But it's amazing how many people bring kids with them. And so they need to, you know, have something to keep the kids busy. And
sure.
They're very well behaved in the museum, incidentally. I sit there at my vendor table and sign books and pose for pictures. It's true. People who see me on television want to get their picture taken with me. They always remark how I've lost weight since they saw me on the tube, forgetting that television ads. 15 or 20 pounds.
So, do you have a new book out? I am not up to date on your work.
Well, not really. The last book was Science Was Wrong. And
that's
got 14 chapters. Kathleen Marden and I co-authored that. We also co-authored Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. Kathy is an expert on abductions, and she's...
I know. I had Kathy on a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, okay. Well, then you know all about Kathleen.
Yes.
And that book, Science Was Wrong, I still get a kick out of it. We should put out a second volume because 14 chapters, we each did 7. And each one, the touching point, the start-off point was something stupid said by somebody who was supposedly smart. You know, men will never fly any distance in an airplane, said the greatest American astronomer of the 19th century, 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight. you know, good timing. The British Astronomer Royal, and Astronomer Royal is somehow something about getting that title makes people seem to act rather stupidly or arrogantly. Maybe it's both. 1956, space travel is utter bilge. Why would anybody spend the money? What good would it do? What we need is better instruments for astronomy. And so what field has benefited the most from space travel, which started a year after the British Astronomer Royal made that stupid statement? Astronomy. You know, there's a new book out, incidentally, by Terence Dickinson, and it's about the Hubble Space Telescope. And I haven't seen my copy yet, but I understand it's truly spectacular because the whole universe is just opened up. You know, Galileo was a big step when somebody finally looked at it through a telescope, much to the church's discomfort, let's put it that way.
Yeah, indeed.
Galileo saw that there were these lights going around Jupiter. They weren't going around the sun, four satellites that are easily visible. And, now the Hubble has just opened up things incredibly. And because it's above the atmosphere and has super sensitive cameras and you can focus on the same area for a long time and so forth and so on, it gives us an appreciation of how wrong we were when we said man is at the top of the heap, everything revolves around man, you know. And Copernicus, whose book was banned for 300 years, said, no, the sun is the center of the universe. Oh my goodness, we can't say stupid things like that, can we?
Yeah, sure.
Anyway, what I'm saying is, from Galileo to the Hubble, incredible opening up of the universe. And now, the really important thing is Kepler, the great scientist named Kepler. But, you know, that's the satellite that's spotting planets, exoplanets. Of course, we knew that there weren't any other planets besides ours, right? Wrong.
Right.
Sorry. So it's exciting to see how our view of ourselves has got to change. We're not at the top of the heap. We're not the big shots around. We're not anything special except to us, except maybe in one way. I think from an alien viewpoint, we're a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare. Look at our track record. We killed 50 million of our own kind in World War II. We destroyed, 1,700 cities. People say, why would they come here? And the simplest answer is to keep us from going out there, because nobody out there would want such a primitive society. And where I get into the picture in ways that most people don't, I'm part of my work in industry. My set records for working on canceled government-sponsored research and development programs. You know, that's a dubious distinction. But anyway, I can speak about an ultimate for us means of getting to the stars. And, you know, it's hard to recognize how much change there has been, unless you lived through it. I mean, I'm going to turn 79 next week, and so I've seen a lot of life go by me and some changes. But one of the things I did in industry was work on nuclear fusion propulsion systems. And you say, who cares? Well, as it turns out, nuclear fusion is what produces most of the energy in the universe. We don't talk about it every day, but every star out there is a fusion factory. That's the process that produces the energy in all the stars everywhere, every galaxy, everywhere. We figured it out. We Johnny-come-latelys in 1938, not very long ago. And our first nuclear fission device went up in 1945, and our first nuclear fusion device, it had a name, Mike, the first H-bomb. Don't ask me why they called it Mike, because I don't really know, but it was let off in 1952. It released the energy of 10 million tons of TNT. Yeah. A big bomb in 1944 in World War II was 10 tons of TNT, energy release equivalent. By 1952, we set one off that was 10 million tons. And the Russians, incidentally, set one off a few years later. 50 million tons of TNT in one device. Now, think about that for a minute. Anybody smart would say, well, gee, we can use that for propulsion, can't we? Yeah, we can, if you want to spend the money. You can kick particles out the back end of a fusion rocket that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. That means we can get to the stars. And it further means any sensible alien out there wouldn't want us out there. We're not nice guys. So it changes one's perspective greatly that in such a short period of time, instead of being the center of the universe, we're one of the backward places. But we are capable of getting out there. And I think every advanced civilization would have as a general rule, try to protect your own security. You know, quarantine those idiots over on Earth. You know, we don't want them out here. And what is very strange to me is that the astronomical community doesn't seem to understand that the stars are within reach. They think if it's not being done in a university, well, there's no research going on. And believe it or not, I've had two different professors tell me, Stan, if Roswell really happened, and I'm the original civilian investigator of the Roswell incident starting back in 1978, if Roswell really happened, they'd have had to pull half the physicists off all the college campuses to deal with that. I just laughed my head off. Are you forgetting that we had Los Alamos and Sandia and Oak Ridge and Hanford, each employing thousands of people, all of them with security clearances, and many of them very highly talented professionals? Los Alamos had 7,000 people at that time. When I was working on nuclear airplanes way back in the old days in 1958 at General Electric, household name, we only spent $100 million that year. 1958, that was a lot of money.
Wow.
We employed 3,500 people, 1,100 of them engineers and scientists. So this wasn't a project with, you know, six professors and 25 grad students, which would be a big campus project. It was peanuts, you know, $100 million, what the heck. And so I find that I'm constantly having to remind people about the real world in which we live. And one of the realities is that we, if we want to, could go to the stars if we wanted to spend the money. I don't think we should. You know, it's like going to the moon in 1955, let's say. We had the basic principle. It only took $20 billion to do it, you know. And there's another myth that's around. I don't know why, but I don't think the general public serves this myth and believes in it. But I think the ancient academics and fossilized physicists do. Governments can't keep secrets, I'm told every once in a while by somebody who insists that the largest free and open society, the United States, couldn't possibly keep secrets.
Well, who said it's the largest free and open society?
Well, what I'm saying is, yeah, you're right. That's a good question. but here are just a few examples, just to understand. The first spy satellite, the Corona spy satellite, name of a town in New Mexico, not far from where a saucer crashed, as a matter of fact. They also make cigars in Cuba called Coronas. But anyway, the Corona spy satellite, our first one, after 12 failures in secret, the 13th one was a success. That we learned more about the Russian military installations than all the U-2 flights which had preceded it. Now, you'd think that once we were successful, we'd have trumpeted all over the planet, look how smart we are, we found out about those Russians. The first public statement about the existence of the Corona spy satellite was 1995. The first flight was 1960. That's keeping a secret, and we're talking billions of dollars in there. The stealth aircraft only cost $10 billion over 10 years. Lockheed did that, not a university. The National Reconnaissance Office, NRO, they build the big spy satellites, some of which cost $500 million, if you can believe They had a project going with Boeing to change the satellites that they were using and see if they could find a better way of doing things. They spent $13 billion and had to cancel the program because they didn't get what they want. And secret. Can't keep secrets? Who's kidding? Who? No, I'll admit, there are prominent people who think we can't keep secrets. Dr. Tyson, head of the Hayden Planetarium, told people at Penn State University in a public lecture that the proof that we can't keep secrets, the government, that is how much we know about President Clinton's genitalia. Isn't that a clever remark? It tells a lot about the NSA and the OSI, and, you know, all those alphabet soup agencies. So I live in a strange world. On the one side are all the foolishnesses said by the nasty, noisy negativists, and the other side is reality. And people are coming around quite quickly to the reality side, I think.
I think so, too. I think that Mars is very, very important now. And as far as the disclosure, so-called disclosure project, I think that it's well underway, of course, but that the Mars story seems to be a platform for the mass mind to have these dribbles seeping out every daily basis, acclimatizing people to the idea. And I was wondering how much insider information you've got about all that.
About Mars, not a lot, although I do know that I sat on a panel about 12 years ago in Florida about going to Mars, and a NASA representative said, you know, we're really thinking about using a nuclear upper stage. That was only about 30 years late, back in the 60s, mind you. When I worked for Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab, we tested a nuclear rocket upper stage. And Los Alamos tested a little larger one. Their rocket, less than 8 feet in diameter, you know, not any bigger than a car, certainly, it operated at a power level of 4,400 megawatts. Now, Grand Coulee Dam, which is rather huge, produces 2,200 megawatts. It's one little rocket engine. Produced 4,400 megawatts. But they canceled the program, of course. So the advantage of a nuclear rocket as an upper stage is it doubles or triples, depending on details, the payload you can send to Mars. And frankly, everybody I knew in the space industry, and I was in it back in the 60s, thought that by now we'd have a base on Mars. We'd certainly have a base on the moon. And people would have gone to Mars and so forth. And so I'm irked at the lack of leadership provided by the government. Well, you know, I suppose everybody is. I don't know. But, well, you know, the nuclear navy has been around. The first nuclear submarine, 1956. That's a long time ago. We have nuclear aircraft carriers. And people look at me when I say this, but I can't help it. It's the truth. That can operate for 18 years without refueling. So why aren't we going to the stars?
Okay, let me interrupt you. You said we certainly have one on the moon, as if you were saying, I'll have another cup of coffee, please. And I'd like to just go back to that, because what do you mean?
We expected that we'd have a base on the moon. Why not? We know how to do it.
But
no leadership.
What do you say about all of the discussion about entire cities on the dark side of the moon?
I put it in my very large gray basket. Maybe. Maybe. And, you know, people say, why haven't we gone there? Maybe it's because the aliens say, stay the heck off our planet, buddy. You know, I don't know. I can't imagine. Remember that President Nixon said that the reason Apollo 19 wasn't launched was that we ran out of money. All the money had been spent. We built the craft. That was kind of a flimsy excuse. And you're going to pay the Navy guys.
Wasn't there an astronaut that said that that we were warned off the moon?
Well, I've heard stories like that, and it's part of that gray basket. I hear all kinds of strange stories. And, you know, it may be that we and the Russians decided, I guess we better leave those aliens alone. The Chinese are talking about going to the moon now.
I know.
And It's an interesting question. What will the world be like in 10 years? I hope I'm still around. Both my parents live to be 90, so I have a good chance of making it. But, you know, there are a lot of unknowns here, and part of them is the whole secrecy business. And, you know, something I am going to be doing an interview in California next week, and part of it will be going over Blue Book and stuff, Project Blue Book, and the whole business about this government cover-up and disclosure and all this stuff. Incidentally, there was a conference on disclosure at the end of April and beginning of May in Washington, D.C.
Oh, yes.
Citizens Hearing on Disclosure. And I was there.
I know you were.
Pitch and, you know, well, there were six former congressmen who sat in panelists, and they listened to us tell stories, and, you know, they asked questions and all that. And they recommended, one of the funniest things, the bottom line of the conference is that these former congressmen said the place to get support is not from Congress. They won't do anything. Go to the United Nations. And the funny thing is, I spoke at the United Nations in 1978, and again a couple of years later. We made some progress. The General Assembly was very responsive, but the United States put a kibosh on it. We aren't going to do nothing about flying saucers. Well, I think now the U.S. may be less powerful in being able to influence what other people do. So it might not be a bad idea to go to the United Nations, but, you know, stop and think for a minute. Everything changes as soon as there's an announcement that, oh, by the way, planet Earth is being visited by intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft. Everything changes. Why? It affects religion. Did God make just us? The Pope has already said that God made our brethren in outer space just as he made us. Well, that's a big line coming from the Pope. But what do we do about the fact that this year alone, we will spend $1 trillion on things military? Is that just going to disappear? People say, why are you opposed to disclosure? I say, well, I want the planet to know that aliens are visiting. I don't think we should be putting highly classified technological data out on the table unless the Russians and the Chinese do, too. That's national security matters, you know. And until we decide that, you know, we really should feed the starving people, that would be a better goal than spending all that we spent on things military.
Do you really think that they're not in cahoots? I mean, the Russians, the Chinese, and the United States, we all know there is one central government, and they've certainly done everything to push forward that agenda. So even though we're played by the story that these governments are all in opposition, are you sure that believe that?
I'm not sure that they're not working together. After all, people in power, there's a basic rule, dynamic laws of Earth. People in power want to stay in power. You ever hear a violation of that law? And somebody in power didn't want to stay in power? You know, one of my four reasons for the cover-up, no, actually I have six, I guess, but one of them is if an announcement were to be made tomorrow by highly believable people, the Queen and the Pope, how's that for an odd couple to say, indeed, the planet is being visited.
You just said highly incredible people, and I'm having a hard time making that segue. No offense.
No, that would be a big help. But one of the things that would happen, besides church attendance going up, mental hospital admissions going up, the stock market going down, uncertainty is always the enemy of stability on the stock market. I think the younger generation these days, maybe not 30 years ago, but these days, would push for a new view of ourselves instead of as Canadians, Americans, Greeks, Peruvians, whatever, as Earthlings.
Yes,
I mean, from an alien viewpoint, we are all Earthlings, but we don't seem to like that very much. And no government wants its people to owe their allegiance to the planet, do they? I can't imagine them wanting that. And, of course, then you have your leading bright lights, people like, again, the English Astronomer Royal, the new one. Last year, he made the great statement that only kooks see UFOs. Honest to God, I mean, one of the stupidest things I've heard. And the English astronomer royals have said a lot of stupid things over the years.
It's a lot of inbreeding.
I suppose. It's one of those crazy things that why would somebody say something like that without providing any evidence, any data, any sense to the remark? You know, the loads of pilot sightings, I suppose he never flies, maybe, and so he doesn't care if a kook is flying his airplane or not.
Well, we know that there's still, you know, I mean, there's still this struggle to push forward this agenda. So we've got all these patsies in these places of, let's say, media and semi-power putting out the addition that we're supposed to believe. Nonetheless, everywhere around the planet, there is nonstop UFO activity. There's nonstop information. Sure. The people are becoming more awake to this. There's definitely disclosure underway.
Well, I hope that at least some things will be disclosed. And certainly the Mutual UFO Network, which is having its annual symposium as we speak in Las Vegas, nice place to have a symposium. I'm not there this year. I'm there most years. MUFON gets over 600 reports a month of UFO sightings. I get people saying to me, Stan, how come I haven't heard about any UFO sightings in the last few months? 600 a month, MUFON gets. And I know from asking my audiences, most people don't report their sightings, still because of fear of ridicule. So, you know, the real world and the imaginary world of the nasty, noisy, negative, you know, they don't often come together. And I get strange looks when I say that SETI, you know, S-E-T-I, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence? No. Silly effort to investigate. That's what SETI stands for. Well, think about it for a minute. Supposedly, aliens out there are going to use techniques appropriate to send us a signal that we will be able to pick up and interpret and understand, comprehend. We've had radio, long-distance radio, since 1901. Not very long ago. And yet they're stuck at that level of technology. I know of no area of technology where we're using the same techniques now as we did 50 years ago.
Not counting
5,000 or 5 million or whatever. But we're waiting to hear a signal from them. Hi there, Earthlings! And one of the leading lights of SETI has said, when we make contact, there could be a civilization as close as 1,000 light years. And when we make contact, it'll be one of the great events in man's history, and they'll help us solve our problems. Honest to God. And when I think about that, help us solve our problems. Hey, you guys, we got a problem here. Can you help us 2,000 years later? 2,000 years later. Hey, guys, what can we do for you? We know how to solve that problem. I mean, does that make any sense? It's pretty dumb. And admittedly, they'd be up the creek without a paddle if aliens are landing here, because maybe they need to learn sign language instead of listening for radio signals. You know, sometimes it's farcical what goes on in the world. And I'm still an optimist because, you know, Max Planck, great German physicist a long time ago, said, new ideas come to be accepted, not because your opponents come to believe in them, but because your opponents die and a new generation grows up that's accustomed to them. And that's probably what's happening with UFOs. Most people today, judging by the people I talk to, believe that there's life all over the place out there. Some of it's more advanced than we are. Kepler is partly responsible for that. A magnificent device. Shut down for the moment. But, you know, suddenly man wakes up, not alone. Uh-oh, now what?
Yeah.
But there's another part to this, too. And the religious people even have been coming around to the notion of, gee, maybe we're not the big shots, and, you know, maybe we need to allow a little room for other viewpoints and all that sort of thing. I'm pleased about that, and I hope my great-grandson, when he grows up, he's only five now, will be part of a world in which it's assumed that there's life all over the place out there.
Well, I think one of the elements that's changing people so much is the awareness of how we are so rapidly destroying the planet. And, you know, the good old days where everybody had a chicken in the pot and life was peaceful and there was room to grow are behind us. And now we're in an utterly struggling planet with just issue after every day. We've got a new big problem. And I think that this is helping people. Certainly there are those that are waiting for the big spaceship to come and save all the good guys. But, you know, the people that are grounded in reality are finally saying, okay, let's hope that there are other stations in the universe where we have more highly evolved civilization, because we are not doing very well here on planet Earth.
Well, take a look at just a simple number. We Earthlings this year will spend $1 trillion on things military. And thousands of children die needlessly of preventable disease or starvation every day. Those two numbers don't make any sense together, do they?
But that's you're talking about just the United States, right?
No, the planet is spending $1 trillion, so half of that's the United States. The planet is spending $1 trillion on things military. $1 trillion every year.
Sure, you've got to have money for war.
Well, that's my point, that at some point there ought to be somebody who says, hey, you know, there must be a better way of doing this. And other remarkable things have happened. Who would have said 40 years ago that you could sit in front of a device on your desk and be in touch with over 1 billion people all around the planet? They call it the Internet. You know, think about that for a minute. That's extraordinary.
Yes, it is.
In a lot of different directions. And, you know, Moore's Law, most people never heard of Moore's Law, but Moore's was one of the founders of Intel, which makes those chips, you know. And he discovered a number of years ago that the number of transistors you can put on a chip doubles about every year or two.
Whoa.
That doesn't sound like a lot, but it's gone on steadily for more than 40 years. And two times two times two times two. Now we're getting to the point where those chips can be awful small and the chips can be awful powerful. And it's been steady. It hasn't stopped. And that's one of the problems that some of our leading lights seem to think, that we've reached the limits. We know all there is to know. Not much is going to change. And I think they're full of baloney. You know, you can have a very successful delicatessen selling the baloney of the noisy negativists and the ancient academics. They've been wrong about everything. That's why I mentioned that book, Science Was Wrong. It's a wholly different book, incidentally, than Captured or My Flying Saucers in Science. And everybody can get access to my books. I'm not hiding. www.stantonfriedman.com. And incidentally, I am very much pleased by the fact of two new books this year about UFO abductions, quite respectable books. You had Kathleen Marden on talking about the alien abduction files. She and Denise Stoner have put together an excellent book, being very well received. But there's another one out there, too, Dr. Don Dondery. Don is a retired professor of psychology from McGill University in Montreal. His book is UFOs, ETs, and Alien Abductions: A Scientist Looks at the Evidence. And I have the greatest respect for Don because he had guts enough many years ago when I spoke at McGill. He introduced me. And most professors wouldn't go near a guy talking about flying saucers on a stage in front of a big audience. We had a huge audience. So Don's very sharp. He and I were at the University of Chicago at the same time. We didn't know each other, but back in the early 50s. So when you get two respectable books about abductions, hey, we're making progress, you know, coming out within a few months of each other. I don't have this year's MUFON papers yet, but I know that there are scientists who are giving papers there as we speak.
Of course, this abduction phenomena certainly does help keep people in fear about the whole alien story.
Well, yeah, except that, you know, we don't hear reports of them grabbing them and clobbering them and leaving the bodies. It's catch and release, if you will, to use a common hunting or fishing analogy. And, you know, people say, why the abductions? And I say, look, when I was in high school a long time ago, I cut up a frog. And millions of people cut up frogs. Is it because frogs were important to our society? Were we trying to breed bigger ones for better dinners? No. It's a teaching tool. So maybe most of the abductions are being done by graduate students.
Right, except that they keep repeating. The story repeats that, and I'd like to get into this in the last quarter of our conversation. Of course, the ongoing story is about the hybrid, the creation of a hybrid species, and people coming out and saying that they are hybrids. And even Denise talked about that in the book with Kathleen. Yeah. So what can you share with us as far as your understanding of that whole aspect?
Well, one thing we do know that we didn't know 60 years ago was about DNA and how certain features of our DNA are very rare. I had a son who was a hemophiliac. Only 1 in 10,000. Had hemophilia. It's a genetic defect. So if you're looking for special characteristics, you got to pick up a lot of specimens, don't you? Because not everybody has it. So that may be one of the things they're doing is looking for hybridization material. You know, we tend to forget. You take a herd of prize cattle, they may all have the same father. You think about that. You know, not a lot of variety there. All Black Angus, that kind of thing. But with people, we're undifferentiated. We got a zillion different characteristics, and you want to find good ones, you better do a lot of looking and check them all out. You know, the hybrid program is looking for the best possibility in maybe a lot of areas. We could use some improvement in our thinking capability. We could use some improvement in our resistance to bacteria, let's say. I got a kick just the other day. Somebody wrote that, an astronomer, of course. To them, we are worth no more than bacteria. And I have to say, sorry, but any society which can explode 2,000 nuclear weapons, which we have, thank goodness, only two of them on people, is a society you better be concerned about. And I frankly think one reason for coming here is to make sure we don't go out there. We're not nice.
Right. I agree.
Quarantine. I mean, you know, if you were describing a society that has acted the way ours has over the last 50 years, you wouldn't say good things about it, would you?
No.
I can't imagine thinking, oh, nice guys. Gee, isn't that attractive? No, we're not.
Well, especially with the secret space war program that's underway, and you probably know a lot more about that than we do, but it would appear to me that this would be a moment when not only are we being observed, as you say, as a hostile society, but now we are really going out beyond our borders. So what's the scoop on that?
I don't have a good scoop. That's, as I said before, in my gray basket. I've been asked a lot of things about the secret programs, you know, the base on Mars, if there is one, and all those bases, and the Serpo project, and, you know, people being taken off for 8 years and then brought back. And I need to see more evidence about that. And, you know, there's a big industry and new creative ideas for all the things that we don't know about what the government is doing.
True.
And there's certainly plenty of them, but we need evidence. And there isn't a lot of evidence. And frankly, there are two groups that aren't doing their job on this planet. One of them is the journalists, the media, if you will. The other is the scientific community. You know, take a very simple fact. An Air Force General, Carol Bolander, said in 1969, in a memo which resulted in the closure of the old Air Force Project Blue Book, he made a very important statement. he was asked, what should we do about Blue Book? Because the University of Colorado had said, cancel it, it's not doing anything useful. And they were probably right about that. But he said, reports of UFOs, which could affect national security, are made in accordance with Joint Army Navy Air Force Publication 146 or Air Force Manual 55-11 and are not part of the Blue Book system. That's an extraordinary statement. And he went on, two paragraphs later, if we close Project Blue Book, the public won't have a place to report UFO sightings. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security would continue to be investigated using the procedures established for that purpose. And yet the Air Force since 1969 has consistently said, we're not doing anything about UFOs, lying through their teeth. I've yet to see a major media group pick up on what General Bolander said. And incidentally, I talked to him on the phone. He's dead now. You can't call him to be our next guest, but that would be neat. It would have been. I talked to him on the phone. I said, it sounds like you're saying there are two separate channels for UFO information. He said, yes. I said, you know, obviously, if a saucer goes down the runway at a Strategic Air Command base where nuclear weapons are stored, that's a national security problem. They're not supposed to be there. But if you and I go outside and look up in the sky and there go two saucers going by, big deal, happens all over the place all the time. No big deal, really. So if we can get the media awakened, maybe then things would change rapidly. I don't think they have guts enough to. You know, there's a strange little story that illustrates the media's resistance to new ideas in this area. Back in 1952, orders were issued to military pilots, shoot down UFOs if they don't land when instructed to do so. Now, you can make all kinds of cartoons about that, but the important thing is that story was carried in many papers, Louisville Courier Journal, you know, Pulitzer's paper, and a whole bunch of others, but not in the New York Times or the Washington Post. And an Air Force general was quoted as saying, we scrambled jets 300 times, just routine. Why didn't the Post and the New York Times carry it? And you may remember President Kennedy saying he wished the Times had run with the we're going to invade Cuba story. It would have saved him a lot of embarrassment. You know?
Yeah.
So the press isn't doing its job. The scientific community isn't doing its job. That leaves
and the government isn't certainly doing its job.
Who is?
The government.
Oh, yeah, covering up. Yeah, it's a crazy world. Who's accountable? Well, you know, a lot of people don't realize, within 2 weeks of the start of World War II, a director of censorship was appointed. Make sure people weren't saying things that would give the enemy comfort and information. Loose lips sink ships, you know, and all that sort of stuff. One of the words that the press couldn't use was uranium, incidentally. That's really true. They couldn't write about the success or failure of the Japanese Fugo balloon program. They were releasing balloons with bombs attached out over the Pacific, and the prevailing winds are to the east, so they were flying over the United States. And we couldn't say. Actually, a family did get killed by monkeying with one of those balloons. But I'm just mentioning that as, well, another, if people live in Tennessee, one of the biggest facilities for the development of nuclear weapons was the gaseous diffusion plant at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. It was a mile long, literally. This is built during the war, and it used 5% of the electrical power produced in the entire country to separate uranium isotopes. Nice little secret project there. The reason it was in Tennessee, incidentally, is because they had Tennessee Valley Authority, and that's there were a lot of power around and available because things weren't going very well. But it is interesting that we don't have an outcry from the press moguls about telling the truth about flying saucers.
Well, the media is controlled. We know that.
Well, it's time we uncontrolled them.
Yes, that's true. Are you doing your job, Stanton?
Well, I'm trying to. Everywhere I go, I talk big. I had a call from somebody not too long ago. How come you're still alive, Stan? What do you mean? Well, you're saying the Air Force is covering up. There's a cosmic Watergate. Why didn't they just knock you off? And I said, well, I've been accessible. When you drive from Albuquerque to Roswell, it's 200 miles and nothing. I used to have a live answering service. Anybody could call and find out where I was going to be when, you know, all that sort of stuff. But maybe I'm doing what the government wants, getting people
accustomed to the idea. Yeah, I was going to say that, because they said that to me, too. Why aren't you dead because of all the things you expose? And the answer is because we are the voice of this dissemination of information. That they know it's got to come out. They know they can't hold this wall up much longer. And so we are the ones that are slowly helping people get their minds around it, don't you think?
Yes, I do, as a matter of fact. And I think I had a guy come up to me after a lecture indicating he had a lot of inside connections and stuff, and they were aware of me. But he also acknowledged that they were aware that I respected security. It's against the law, for example, to solicit classified information from people who have it and you don't have a clearance or a need to know for it. It's not against the law to have it. It's against the law to solicit it from somebody like that. I don't do that.
What about
the freedom
of information?
If somebody wants to give me something, that's okay.
What about the Freedom of Information Act? Has that gone by the by?
Well, it's still around. It doesn't do you much good, but, I'd be happy to provide somebody who has a real interest. 156 pages of top secret Umbra National Security Agency UFO materials. There's a little kicker. You can only read one sentence per page. Everything else is whited out.
This is true. I've seen some of those documents.
And the CIA, I got lots of pages where there are five or six words you can read. Everything else is blacked out. So freedom of information gets you what you're supposed to get.
Yeah, a page that says, according to blackout, 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 this has been a public broadcast system.
It's kind of weird. And, you know, I know newspapers are having a tough time these days because of the Internet and other things. And so I guess they don't want to pay people to do investigative journalism. Let them read whatever they want on the Internet, you know. But,
well, of course, if they would give us a little bit more truth, we might go back to that's all hypothetical anyway, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and I'm still an optimist, or I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. I've got lectures coming up. They're all on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. It lists a lot of lectures that I have coming up. As a matter of fact, I'll be at MUFON, Arizona, the 27th, I guess it is. It's on the website, of July. And I've got lectures in Atlanta in September, in Fort Wayne, Indiana, in Portland, Maine, in Kansas City.
Let me interrupt you and say, how did a cool climate get into all of your locations? Arizona in July? Yikers!
Hey, I live in California. I'm going to be out there, too, just before the Arizona talk. And I'll wear a hat. What else can you do? I know that this year has been a very hot year for a lot of people, and Roswell's always hot. It gets up over 100, but it's dry, very dry.
Yeah, I hear that the West Coast is cooking, so you take care, watch out, and wear your hat.
I'm going to do that. I'll tell you, you lose a little hair, and boy, you can get a sunburn up there pretty fast.
All right, listen, everybody, we're just about to sign out with, we've been listening to Stanton Freeman, really one of our best voices for the UFO phenomenon, knowledge about ET, abduction, you name it. This is a man you want to go to hear. So be sure to check out his site, stantonfreeman.com, and know that this is a warrior who has been out there for decades talking the truth to anyone who can hear it. So with that, Stanton Freeman, I thank you again. The time just flies with you. But I do have 3 minutes left. So as most radio hosts will do, I'd love to ask you to leave us with a thought to ponder about the great beyond.
The world of our grandchildren is going to be very different from the world of our grandparents. in an important way, which is going to be different, is that everybody will be aware that it's a huge universe with lots of civilizations, and we have a certain responsibility to make sure that we don't make it a worse place than it is. Let's improve the planet. Let's look after our people. Let's leave the killing to somebody somewhere else. Let's get on with being Earthlings. I think that's an important mission. And I think we're at the time where we have the tools to study the universe out there. There's a new book out about the Hubble telescope results. It's incredible. Terence Dickinson did that. And maybe we need to recognize we're not so stupid that we can't handle being part of a galactic community. We need to wake up. I'm an optimist.
Well said. Well said. Thank you, Stanton.
My pleasure.
Okay, people, you get the message. We're trying. Anybody who's listening to this show is part of the team that's really working to raise the vibration on this planet. So take those words to heart and share with everyone you know the words that you've heard from Stanton. And thank you. I thank you again for tuning in today on Beyond the Matrix, the radio program that it doesn't just ask you to think outside of the box. It implores you. It dares you to think outside the box of convention and soar with the eagles in the free thought zone. I've been your host, Patricia Corey. Thank you. I will be back with you next week in my evening hour, which, by the way, here in Europe is the middle of the night. So please listen so that when I wake up, I know that I've got a lot of friends out there that I'm reaching at 6 o'clock in the morning, my time. Okay, everybody, thanks a lot. Oh, and don't forget, my Egypt trip, November 13 to 25, is signing now. Please go to my site, SyrianRevelations.net, to find out more about that. And have a wonderful day. Thanks again to Stanton. This is Patricia Corey, your alien kind of gal, signing out. Nanu, nanu. That's me. Goodbye.